Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering canoes, kayaks, and advice for anyone wanting to experience solitude on Wisconsin waterways. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or RutabagaShop.com.
Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and we are visiting now with Joan Hall. She is the chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English, and Volume 5, Through the Letter Z, has just been sent to press. So I think Joan is breathing a sigh of relief, probably. Not that her work is done, but it seemed like a great time to have her back to talk about why we say the things we do and where these different things come from. Joan, thanks so much for coming in today.
You're very welcome.
So how much does English vary from region to region? And are there regions that you define that are somewhat homogeneous and so they're chunks of the country? Or are we talking about micro-linguistic climates, basically?
Well, both macro and micro. There are many, many different regionalisms that still exist. Some people like to think that because of our travel capacities and advertising in the media, that our language is becoming homogenized. But the evidence we have shows that there are still thousands and thousands of words and phrases and pronunciations and even bits of grammar and syntax that vary from one part of the country to another. And for us, a region can be a very large part of the country, such as everything east of the Mississippi River, or a very small part, such as a part of a city, Baltimore, Maryland, for instance. Mm. And so we're looking for very small differences and very large ones as well.
Well, I know that people really love to join in and ask their questions and have you settle arguments about how to say different things and what different things mean. So I want to make sure people know how they can join in. You can call 1-800-642-1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, which is The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. So what areas in general, and it sounds like it really depends on what you're talking about, but are there particular areas or states that Wisconsin shares a lot of regionalisms with?
Yes, we have several specified regional labels that we use, recognizing that language doesn't follow state borders and mm-hmm. language doesn't follow any distinct pattern, but Wisconsin is often paired with Minnesota and certainly the UP of Michigan, and we have a regional labels that we call Upper Midwest. We have another one that's North Central that gets down into Illinois, Indiana, Ohio. Wisconsin is part of what we call a Great Lakes region. It's also part of what's known as the Inland North, which is the North starting in eastern New York and going west. And, of course, it's in the general label North. Mm-hmm. So it participates in a lot of different patterns.
Now, of course, there's a big body of water up there between Wisconsin and Canada. But do you see some crossover from things that people might think of as Canadian English that are actually pretty prevalent in Wisconsin, too?
There are a few things in terms of lexicon, but more often we hear slight pronunciation variation that seems to be more Canadian than American, particularly when you get to border areas of Minnesota and mm-hmm. North Dakota, for instance. The oat and a boat kind of thing. And I have been there mm-hmm. sometimes occurs, mm-hmm. and those are Canadian shibboleths.
Now, when people move to another part of the country, do they tend to keep those regionalisms that they grew up with or maybe lived somewhere for, 20 years or something? Do they tend to keep those or do they tend to assimilate in some way? And if it differs, what seems to be the determining factors of why they would either stick with what they know or take on the new phrases or words?
To some extent, it depends on how old they are when they move. Children who move are much more likely to adopt the language of their playmates in whatever new place they've mm-hmm. gone to. Adults tend to be more stable in their communication, but they do discover that if they use a word and people look questioningly at them or say, what? Then they tend to adapt and find out what the local variant is and use that instead. Mm-hmm. But it also depends on the context. So for family words, for instance, what you call your grandparents, are they Oma and Opa? Are they Mima and Papa? Are they Granny and Grampy? That kind of thing that you talk about mainly with your family is not going to change because those are very deeply rooted in who we are and where we came from.
Well, and as you said, the situation, even if you're now traveling from 3,000 miles away instead of down the street, that situation where you're with the same people using those terms, and you probably aren't using those terms, say, in a business meeting in your new right. city. Probably not. I could see it happening. But, but you know, that the situation is constant, even if you yourself have physically moved to another geographic area.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said in the little introduction, Volume 5, Through the Letter Z, or is it Z, is at the printer. First of all, congratulations. That's a huge accomplishment. I know you would say it's not just you, that there have been legions of people working on it over the years. But when will that Volume 5 be available?
It won't be available until March of 2012. But the reason for that is that even though we have sent in all the text, now we have just started to receive page proof. Though we're receiving it as PDFs, it still requires the same amount of tremendously detailed checking. Every running head, you know, those words up at the top mm-hmm. of the dictionary page, every page number, every line to see if it's a loose line or to see if the hyphenation at the end of the line is right, all sorts of terribly detailed things just simply have to be checked.
Wow.
So we're in it for the long haul.
So once you get all that done, what happens after that? And how long did it take to get to this point where Volume 5 is off at the printer?
Well, from the very beginning, it started in 1962, and publication in 2012 is actually kind of nice because that's the 50th anniversary.
It's like you planned it.
Yeah, of Fred Cassidy's being appointed as the chief editor.
Great.
The actual field work didn't start till 1965, but volumes have been coming out regularly through time, 1985, 91, 96, and 2002. So with Volume 5, we get through Zydeco, but we're not done then because a sixth volume of Data will be coming out the following year, and that will include some really interesting features. One will be a section of contrastive maps so that rather than having to sift through five volumes of text to see the synonyms for a potluck meal to know whether where they say that it's a covered dish dinner or a terrine supper or a carry-in dinner or a pitch-in, all of these will be laid out in a single page or facing pages. So you can see these regions.
Oh, that's great.
Right in one place.
Wow. Well, that sounds really interesting. And speaking of food, actually, Judith in Milwaukee has a question. I think that would fit nicely. So let's go to Judith. Hi, Judith.
Yes, my question had to do with a phrase that my son's girlfriend used. She recently moved here from Kansas, although her family in part is from the South. And after they finished dinner one night and were going to sit down and watch TV, she asked him, shouldn't we put up the food first? And he just kind of looked at her and wasn't sure what she meant, up where. And instead of, she meant to put it away, to cover it and put it away. But she said all her life her family has used the phrase, put up the food.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. I can't tell you for sure whether that particular sense is in Volume 5. That would be in an earlier volume, so I can indeed look it up. But phrases,
it sounds like it's familiar to you, Joan.
Yes, phrases with up are very, very versatile. Often the up means do something to completion, so you finish up. But up is very variable in terms of things like put up a hem. Do you put mm-hmm. a hem up
or
do you put it in or do
or
you
take
it up?
Yeah.
but, and put is...
Well, and to do something upright kind of implies that completion and that success. So I see what you mean about putting up something would mean taking care of it.
I can tell you that we have several senses for put up. One is to put away, stow away, to save for future use. And that is labeled chiefly South and South Midland, but we do have an example in Missouri, which is close to Kansas, and other senses. One is to set to cooking, to prepare food or drink, as in, I'm going to put up the coffee. So that's related. It doesn't surprise me at all to hear this kind of example.
And it would be more prevalent, you wouldn't hear it as often in our area.
Well, it depends. Some of these things come from other languages. They're calques of, say, a German phrase or a Swedish phrase, something like that. To cook coffee, for instance, is found in a lot of Scandinavian languages. Mm-hmm. So if it does turn out to be from another language, then you would expect that that would follow immigration patterns. But if it's German, you might expect to hear that, too. So I can't tell you for sure.
So it sounds, Joan, like it depends where, not only where you are, but perhaps what your ethnic background is, too.
Often.
So in a place like Judith's calling from Milwaukee, she probably is hearing a lot of different things there because people are German, Polish, Italian, Irish, whatever, and they're bringing things, whether they realize it or not, from their original language.
Yes, and very often people have no idea that it is a calque or...
Right. And a calc is?
A translation from another language.
Okay. Well, we are talking with Joan Hall, the chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English. You can call with your questions about why you say what you do at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, and we hope that you will. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. So glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Joan Hall, the chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English. And Joan, not surprisingly, we have several people on the phone who want to join in the conversation. So let's go there right now. Jean in Appleton, we're on to you. Hi.
Hello?
Yes.
Are you speaking to me, Jean?
I am.
Ah, it's kind of hard to hear you on the phone for some reason. I have questions about regional pronunciation, which seems to be spreading nationally. And some of these things I noticed first when George W. Bush came into office, that he would never say, I have a good thing, or he would say, I have a good thing. And everybody suddenly started pronouncing the small a as A, the long version. And then there are other words I wonder about. I notice that the local WPR announcers, when they talk about counties, say county, and when they talk about 20-something, they say 20. And the other one which seems to have spread nationally is I thought the plural of house was houses. And all of a sudden, now everybody's talking about houses. Can you explain this?
So an S sound instead of what sounds like a Z. Houses, houses.
Yeah, I suspect it's what we call a pronunciation spelling, or a spelling pronunciation, that is, where people see house and they know house and then assume that you just add an ES and you get houses. What normally happens is that there's a vocalization of the S because it's being followed by a vowel, which has to be vocalized. So if you say houses, there's a little bit more of a gap than if you say houses because you have vocalization for the whole syllable that way. I don't know whether this is primarily among younger people. It wouldn't surprise me. But I know that it happens not just with that word, but with similar words as well.
Well, and Joan, we were talking about the fact that I'm from Chicago, and one of the Chicagoisms that I'm aware of is that final S on a word being an S instead of a Z. So, I mean, the usual thing is DeBears,
yes.
but that sounds like it's what you said, a spelling pronunciation.
Well,
too.
I don't think so. Oh. I think that one's an ethnically based transcription or pronunciation.
Is there a particular ethnic group?
Well, quite a few ethnic groups in the area might do that. Germans and Poles and Germanic languages in general. It's one of the things that Tom Purnell and Joe Salmons, who are doing a project called Wisconsin Englishes, have been focusing on in the Milwaukee area. Mm. So it's not just Chicago, okay. But
but we'll still claim it anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for that call. And Jan in Menominee Falls, we're on to you. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, sure. Judith and Joan. I just wanted to share a little something with you. My mother is 84 years old and has a particularly colorful language. She uses terms and expressions that are unusual. Having grown up with them, I always thought they were normal until I went out into the world mm-hmm. and used them and found out they were unique to her. So over the course of the last year, my family and I have been scribbling on paper on the refrigerator every time she uses one so we wouldn't forget it. And we've collected them all and collaborated it into a Grandma J dictionary and passed it out at Christmas time and had a lot of fun with it. I think it's a nice way to remember some of these things as the family gets watered down through marriage and people are moving out of the region. One of my favorite expressions that my mom has used in the past is an expression of disgust, which goes buaxi, oinksy, poo-poo, pwee-divel, and sour rye.
That's all together?
That's all together.
Wow.
Well, that does sound like a family word.
I don't think you're probably going to find that in the dictionary. But
exactly.
So it's good that it's in your dictionary. And does she appreciate that you're trying to save those things?
Oh, she gets a real kick out of it. Absolutely.
Do you think she's kicking it up a notch just so she gives you some good material?
She thinks that she doesn't understand that it's unusual. She thinks it's perfectly normal. So,
and just out of curiosity, Jan, does your mother come from a particular ethnic background?
She's German. A lot of the words she uses incorporate bits of German in them. My father, grandfather, was from the Minnesota area, and she's second generation U.S. So, my grandfather, in other words, was born mm-hmm. here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, her German is just watered down.
Great.
And I think that has a lot to do with it.
Great. Well, thanks so much for that, Jan. That sounds like a great project that, you know, people do genealogies mm-hmm. often, but this is a different kind of genealogy in a way.
It is. And often people send us samples of things like that, and phrases that they think are unique to the family turn out to be much more widespread. It's just that they hadn't heard other people use them. But now and then, like this last example,
right.
There are things that are distinctly original.
Well, and as I was going to say, yeah, Jan kind of gave both sides of that. Things that you think are widespread and you find out are just your family, and mm-hmm. then other things that you think are so unique and it turns out that they're not.
Right.
Great. Thanks for sharing that, Jan. That sounds like a great project. Sally in Madison's next. Hi, Sally.
Hi. I had read years and years ago when we went down to Florida to see the great wonder of the world, Disneyland world, that the word cracker was also used in Florida, particularly in the areas where there are lots of cattle in the, I think, more the panhandle in the north and central area, that it had been derived from cowboys cracking whips to herd the cattle. And I was recently chastised for giving that explanation because they said, no, it was only a derivative. It was meant to be a racially insensitive term.
Like a derogatory term.
Yeah. It was my understanding, and I looked it up online, and I couldn't find anything per se, but someone in it, somewhere it said that there was a cracker festival until within the last decade it was done away with, where they'd have barbecues and cow riding rodeo events for people to participate in. So do you know anything about that word?
Well, it is often considered derogatory. It's used of a rustic or a hayseed in the South Atlantic states. But that's the kind of term that people often turn around on people and take with pride and call themselves crackers or corn crackers. It's the kind of thing where you better not call me that, but I can call myself that.
Right.
In determining the etymology, we considered the cracking the whip etymology, but decided that probably was not the source, and suggest instead that it may instead come from cracker, meaning a person who brags a lot. But we also related it to corn cracker, which is also a term for a rustic, and that goes back to a more tangible source. But in essence, we don't really know. So I'm sorry I can't tell you the etymology, but if you're using it of another person, I think it's still politic to be very careful.
Great. Thanks for that call, Sally. And I want to remind people that they can call, too, by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can get on the discussion with Joan Hall, the chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer today, she will get you through to us, or you can send an email that she'll get to us, too. talk@wpr.org is the address. And, of course, our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, you can post a comment or a question there. And a listener named Sandy emailed, my husband grew up in Two Rivers, and he grew up using the term hot tamales for what most other Wisconsinites would call barbecue hamburgers. When, as a young adult living in California, he ordered a hot tamale at a local restaurant, he found out the difference. Mm-hmm. Two Rivers seems to have quite a few variances of other quote-unquote ordinary words. Is that a particularly interesting area of the state, Joan?
Well, I hadn't been aware of that, but that kind
sounds
of,
like a field trip is in your future.
Yeah, that actually, one of my colleagues, Luann Finchschneider-Messer, and a friend of hers, Julie Pleer, those two linguists are doing a book on Wisconsin words. Mm-hmm. So I will bring that to their attention.
Great.
We do have an interesting entry on tamale in the upcoming volume, but I can't tell you for sure whether it does
whether they're hot tamales or not. Maybe they're cool tamales. You never know. Actually, Joan, since you're talking about Volume 5, which, as we said, just went to the printer, there are some interesting things that are appearing in that one. And one that really caught my eye is the word so, used with don't or other negative auxiliaries to indicate agreement with a preceding positive statement. And the example is one person saying, I like cake, and the other person saying, so don't I.
Yes, this is extraordinary, isn't
it? That's really interesting. So why, first of all, why the negative in there?
Well, nobody really knows why, but we do know that it's distinctly regional. It's a very New England kind of expression, and it's relatively old-fashioned, though you still do find examples of it. So don't I is the classic phrase, mm-hmm. but it can occur in other contexts, too. He didn't go to school, or he went to school, and so didn't I, mm-hmm. meaning so did I.
Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, I was expecting, I had to read through that a couple times because I thought it would be agreeing with a negative, but it's
yes,
agreeing with a positive.
Yes, yes. And I don't remember what we said for the etymology on that, but I know we looked into it a great deal and still came out feeling a bit puzzled.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that you talk about is, and this one comes up almost every time you're on, I think, the variation of soda or pop. Mm-hmm. But then mm-hmm. a coworker of ours who grew up near Boston, also, you know, the northeast part of the country, said that he grew up calling soda tonic mm-hmm. as a general phrase. And that's in this volume as well. Also on Facebook, someone commented that in the Atlanta region, which is the home of Coca-Cola, Coke is a generic for a bubbly beverage.
Yeah, and it's not just Atlanta. It's throughout much of the South, and that's one of the terms that's actually spreading rather rapidly. So somebody could say, oh, would you like a Coke, Pepsi, or Diet Root Beer?
Right. Wow. That's really interesting. And Dan in Wauwatosa has a question. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was just calling because, kind of like you, I'm a Chicago transplant, and I remember when I first came up here, and someone was asking for a bubbler, and I had no idea what it is. And then I started talking to the people I know up here, and they said, oh, yeah. We always called it like a water fountain back home. And then whenever I tell people that we call them bubblers up here, they don't really get it. So I was wondering if you could kind of explain, you know, how that came about.
It goes back to the old-fashioned kind of drinking fountain that you would have found outside in a park, where there's a stand and then a round porcelain bowl, and in the middle of the bowl there's a little valve that makes the water come bubbling up right in the middle. It doesn't spout as high as a water fountain, and it's kind of the classic old-fashioned example. But our research suggests that what happened was that the Kohler Company had something called a bubbling valve, and that was that little piece in the middle of the porcelain bowl. And so you can call it a bubbling valve, but if you want to take a shortcut, you can call that valve a bubbler. And if you call the valve a bubbler, it doesn't take long before you call the whole unit mm-hmm. a bubbler. And A colleague once did some research and found that the area in which people use the term bubbler for a drinking fountain matches very nicely the marketing area of the Kohler Company as of about 1917.
Wow. So that's where the bubbler came from. And is it surprising to you that it's still used quite a bit when that original type of bubbler, the real bubbler, is pretty much, you don't see them very often at all?
No, not really, because we easily transfer a word to another thing that does the same function. But that, too, is the kind of thing that we use automatically and unselfconsciously until somebody says, "What?"
Mm-hmm. Now, that actually reminds me of the situation of icebox and refrigerator, because the original iceboxes actually had ice in them, but mm-hmm. then, of course, they became more mechanized and it was a refrigerator. Do some people still use icebox for refrigerator?
Some do, but that's a pretty age-graded kind of term. It would be used almost solely by old people who actually remembered iceboxes.
I remember when. Great. Thanks for that call, Dan. And let's go to Orville in Madison. Hi, Orville.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Dr. Hall, do you remember the original editor for the...
Fred Cassidy.
Yeah, Fred Cassidy.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, do you remember his first book called Jamaican Talk?
Yes, I do.
Okay, is there any chance of getting a grad student to update that book? That was one of my questions. My other question is, I have a friend who is Indian. She's from Kerala, but she grew up in Philadelphia. The other day we were speaking together, and she said to me about something. I said, you're soddy. So I said, what? Soddy. She said, S-O-D-D-Y. Have you ever heard that term?
Yes, it will be in Volume 5.
What does it mean?
You're putting me on the spot. I'm not sure I can remember.
Orville, are you trying to figure out if you were being complimented or insulted?
Yeah, it wasn't insulted. It sounded to me like it meant, from the connotation, that you're all wet.
Well, why don't you send me an email at jdhall at wisc.
Yeah.
.edu, and I'll tell you what we have.
Yeah, she said it's used by the black. She grew up with black kids in Philadelphia, and she said the black kids use it a lot. Hmm. So it's sorry.
As for Jamaica Talk, I don't know whether anyone has any ideas about updating that, but Fred's second book, The Dictionary of Jamaican English, has been updated.
Oh, good.
It should be available.
Okay. One last question. If you're in Wisconsin and you have a vixen problem, do you kick it into the tall grass or do you kick it down the road?
I'd kick it down the road, but it would be kicking the can down the road.
Hmm. But what does kick it into the tall grass mean?
Well, my guess is that is
the same thing?
Related to a sports situation where if it's out of bounds, it's kicked out into the tall grass and you have to start over, or you can't get a good shot from there.
Right.
But I confess that I'm not 100% certain of that.
Well, thank you for those questions, Orville. And Karen in Madison next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I've always wondered about the word coupon. I've pronounced that word coupon all of my life until I met my husband-to-be, and he convinced me it should be coupon. But since then, even though he converted me, I have heard the pronunciation coupon by people on television and other people that I think would be maybe more correct in their pronunciation. So I just wonder if that is a regionalism or just curious about that word.
Thanks for that call. And Joan, I've definitely heard those two used fairly frequently.
Yes, both of them are very frequent. And my recollection is that neither one is distinctly regional, but these vary pretty freely. And either one is acceptable. And so don't feel embarrassed. You're free to use whichever you please.
It seems like the way it's spelled, it would be coupon.
Yeah, the same kind of variation happens with cupola or cupola. And I think that in that case, when it's a word that people wouldn't have any understanding of, that is etymologically, you simply do what feels right to you, whether or not anybody else says so or not.
Thanks, Karen. So I'm not sure that we solved the family squabble, but thanks for that call. Matt in Oliva has a question. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Yeah, I have a question on the word ruined. Is it a one-syllable, two-syllable? And I've heard it, I guess, pronounced both ways.
So ruined or ruined, is that it?
Yep.
Yeah, well, I think that most people would agree that ruined is appropriate. You do often hear ruined, but that's often in a kind of a quick offhand or colloquial
very conversational
way, not very carefully articulated. Perhaps the people who would say ruined in fast speech might say ruined in a more careful mode. I don't know. But I think if you use ruined, you're certainly in the mainstream.
And did you have another question, Matt?
Yeah, and also it was kind of funny that people in the South or not around the Midwest go to an ATM, but up here we still call them time machines.
Yeah, right, for take your money everywhere.
Yep.
That's true. I used time machine with my sister in California, and she had no idea what I meant.
Well, and also time machine, people think T-I-M-E, like you're
right.
Suddenly going to... Yeah, transport yourself back to the Middle Ages or something. I actually had an experience of someone visiting here from somewhere else and talking about it and saying, oh, we'll have to stop by the time machine on the way. And they got this really unsettled look on their face. And I, you know, like you
back
said,
to the future.
You get that sense of they don't know what I'm talking about. So you kind of run a tape and you think, oh, time machine. I never thought of it in that other sense. So, but I didn't know that time actually stood for something. Mm-hmm. I never really thought through that. So thanks for that question. We have Frank and Lamson on the line. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question is the correct pronunciation or the more usually accepted pronunciation of the word falcon, or again, in kind of a colloquialism, it's used often in the South or in the East that I've heard. It is, and that is the much more nasal-toned and abrasive-sounding falcon versus falcon. You don't hear of somebody being a falconer, really, unless you're in those areas. It's falconer. What is the true pronunciation?
This one varies a lot also, and I think that for many people it's a spelling pronunciation because they don't have a history with falconry. So they look at F-A-L and it looks like fal, and so that's what they say. I don't think that it's distinctly regional. I think it's more idiosyncratic, and it probably depends on your personal history. If you happen to know about falconry, you're likely to use that term.
And there was also a question about whether the first pronunciation in a dictionary is the correct one.
Well, you have to read the introduction to a dictionary to find out what they do as a policy. It used to be assumed that the first one was preferred, but very often two are equally acceptable. And so I think if both of them are given, you can feel confident in using either one.
We have just about a minute left, but I wanted to ask Joan quickly, were there any favorites of yours in Volume 5 that you really kind of that grabbed your imagination?
One of my favorites has to do with what you call those two long poles that kids walk around on. They have little foot places.
Feet, yeah.
Yeah. And I grew up, as probably most of our listeners did, calling them stilts. But I found that in much of the South, they're called tom walkers or tommy walkers. And that was particularly interesting to me because it turns up in a test called the Boston Naming Test to diagnose aphasia. And you're supposed to look at a picture and call it what you call mm-hmm. it. And you're marked wrong if you don't call it stilts, but if you call it your regional phrase. So I became aware of this and I like it.
That's fascinating. Well, Joan Hall, the time just flew by today. Thanks for coming in. Joan is the chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English. I hope you'll tune in tomorrow at 11. We'll be talking with the author of Crow Planet about noticing and appreciating urban wildlife around us. Stay tuned.